now that your people have chosen you as a leader. Her reluctance is written all over her face, but instead she shrugs. For now, perhaps. And the Nightbringer? The Nightbringer has not been seen since the siege, she says. It has been more than a week. I expected him to have set his brethren free by now. But... She takes in my expression. The rain pours down hard now, a steady lash against the windows. But you feel it too, don't you? Something is coming. Something is coming, I agree. He wants to destroy the scholars, and he plans on using the marshals to do it. Lyra's expression is unreadable. And will you let your people be used? I do not expect the question. Livia, however, appears unsurprised, and I have the distinct feeling that she and Lyra have already had this conversation. If you plan to take the throne back for your nephew, Lyra says, you will need allies to battle the Commandant. Strong allies. You don't have the men to do it on your own. And if you don't want your people utterly destroyed by the Djinn and the Martial Army, I retort, you will need allies too, particularly ones who know the Martials well. We stare at each other like two wary dogs. The Augur mentioned something to me about the Nightbringer a few weeks ago, I offer finally, before the siege on Antium. The truth of all creatures, man or djinn, lies in their name. A spark of interest in Lyra's face. Cook told me something similar, she says. She said that to know the Commandant's story would help destroy her, and I know someone with unique skills who can help us. Us? Help my people, Bloodshrike. I can see how much it costs Lyra to ask this of me. And I, and my allies, will help you win back your nephew's crown. But... She cocks her head, and as I'm trying to puzzle out her look, she whips a dagger from her waist and flings it at me. What the bleeding hells? I pluck the blade out of the air on instinct, and turn it on her in the time it takes to blink twice. How dare! If I'm going to carry Serik's steel, Lyra says quite calmly, then I'd like to learn to use it. And if I'm going to be an ally to a marshal, I would like to fight like one. I gape at her, distantly taking note of Livia's quiet smile. Lyra looks down at Sicarius, and then out the window, and that shadow passes over her face again. Though I wonder, would you teach me to use the bow, Bloodshrike? A memory rises from the haze of the past week. Cook's strong hands as she shot arrow after arrow into the Karkans. I love you, Lyra, she'd said. Lyra's face as Cook howled at her to get me to the Augur's cave. And older memories. Cook's fierceness when she told me she'd murder me if I hurt Lyra. The way, when I healed that old woman, some distant music within her reminded me of the scholar girl. And suddenly, I understand. Mother. I remember the face of my own mother as she went to her death. Strength, my girl, she'd said. Curse this world for what it does to the mothers, for what it does to the daughters. Curse it for making us strong through loss and pain, our hearts torn from our chests again and again. Curse it for forcing us to endure. When I meet the scholar girl's stare, I realize she's been watching me. We do not speak. But for this moment, she knows my heart, and I know hers. Well? Lyra of Serra offers her hand. I take it.
Chapter 58 The Soul Catcher. It takes many days for the ghost to speak his pain. Listening to it chills my blood. He suffers each memory, a rush of violence and selfishness and brutality that, for the first time, he must feel in all its horror. Most of the ghosts have passed quickly, but sometimes their sins are so great that Martha does not let them move on, not until they have suffered what they inflicted. So it is with the ghost of Marcus Farrar. Through it, his brother remains at his side, silent, patient. Having spent the past 9 months tied to his twin's corporeal body, Zach has had plenty of time to suffer what he was. He waits now for his brother. The day finally comes when Martha is satisfied with Marcus's suffering. The twins walk beside me quietly, one on each side. They are empty of anger, of pain, of loneliness. They are ready to pass on. We approach the river, and I turn to the brothers. I sift through their minds dispassionately and find a memory that is joyful. In this case, a day they spent together on the rooftops of Silas before they were taken for Blackcliff. Their father bought them a kite. The winds were fair, and they flew it high. I give the brothers that memory so that they might slip into the river without troubling me further. I take their darkness, that which Blackcliff found within them and nurtured, and Martha consumes it. Where it goes, I do not know. I suspect, however, that it might have something to do with that seething sea I saw when I spoke to Martha and the creatures lurking within it. When I look back at the twins, they are boys once more, untainted by the world. And when they step into the river, they do it together, small hands clasped. The days go swiftly now, and with Martha joined fully to me, I cycle through the ghosts, dividing my attention between many at a time, as easily as if I am made of water and not flesh. The djinn chafe at Martha's power, but though they hiss and whisper at me still, I can usually silence them with a thought, and they trouble me no more, at least for now. When I have been back in the waiting place more than a week, I suddenly feel an outsider's presence far to the north, near Delphinium. It takes me only a moment to realize who it is.
"Leave it," Martha says in my head. "You know she will bring you no joy."
I would like to tell her why I left. I have let go of her, but sometimes old images drift to the shores of my mind, leaving me restless. Perhaps if I do, she will cease to haunt me. I feel Martha sigh, but he speaks no more, and in a half hour I can see her through the trees, pacing back and forth. She is alone. "Liar." She turns, and at the sight of her, something in me twists. An old memory, a kiss, a dream. Her hair like silk between my fingers, her body rising beneath my hands. Behind me, the ghosts whisper, and in the ocean tide of their song, the memory of Liar fades away. I draw on another memory, that of a man who once wore a silver mask and who felt nothing when he did. In my mind, I put on the mask again. "It is not your time yet, Liar of Sarah," I say. "You are not welcome here."
"I thought..." She shudders. "Are you all right? You just left."
"You must go."
"What happened to you?"
Liar whispers.
"You said we would be together. You said we would find a way. But then..."
She shakes her head.
"Why?"
"Thousands across the Empire died, not because of the Karkans, but because of the ghosts. Because the ghosts possessed whomever they could and made them do terrible things. Do you know how they escaped?"
Did Martha...
"I failed to hold the borders. I failed to uphold my duty to the waiting place. I put everything else first. Strangers, friends, family, you. Because of that, the borders fell."
"You didn't know. There was no one to teach you."
She takes a deep breath, her hands pressed together.
"Do not do this, Elias. Do not leave me. I know you're in there. Please, come back to me. I need you. The Bloodshrike needs you. The tribes need you.
I walk to her, take her hands, look down into her face. Whatever I want to feel is dulled now by the steady, soothing presence of Ma'atha, the thrum of ghosts in the waiting place.
Your eyes.
She runs a finger across my brows.
They're like hers.
Like Shaver's, I say, as they should be.
No,
Lya says.
Like the Commandant's.
The words trouble me, but that too will fade, in time. Elias is who I was, I say. The soul catcher, the Banu al-Ma'atha, the chosen of death, that is who I am. But do not despair. We are, all of us, just visitors in each other's lives. You will forget my visit soon enough. I reach down and kiss her on the forehead. Be well, Lyre of Sarah. When I turn away, she sobs, a soul-deep cry of wounded betrayal.
Take this!
Her voice is wretched, her face streaming tears. She tears a wooden armlet from her bicep and shoves it into my hands.
I don't want it!
She turns away then, makes for the horse waiting nearby. Moments later, I am alone. The wood is still warm from her body. When I touch it, some part of me calls out in rage from behind a shut door, demanding to be set free. But a second later, I shake my head, frowning. The feeling fades. I think to cast the armlet to the grass. I do not need it, and neither does the girl. Something makes me put it in my pocket instead. I try to turn back to the ghosts, to my work, but I am perturbed, and eventually I find myself at the base of a tree, near the spring not far from the ruins of Shaver's cabin, staring out at the water. A memory rises in my mind.
Soon you will learn the cost of your vow, my brother. I hope you do not think too ill of me.
Is that what this feeling is inside? Anger at Shaver?
It is not anger, child,
Martha says gently.
It is simply that you feel your mortality. But you have no mortality anymore. You will live as long as you can serve.
It's not mortality I feel, I say, though it is something uniquely mortal.
Sadness.
A type of sadness, I say, called loneliness. There is a long silence, so long that I think he has left me. Then I feel the earth shift around me, the tree's roots rumble, curving, softening, until they fashion themselves around me into a sort of seat. Vines grow, and flowers burst from them.
You are not alone, Banu al-Ma'atha. I am here with you.
A ghost drifts close to me, flitting about in agitation, searching, always searching. I know her, the Wisp.
Hello, young one.
Her hand drifts across my face.
Have you seen my lovey?
I have not, I say, but this time I give her all of my attention. Can you tell me her name?
Lovey.
I nod, feeling none of the impatience I felt before. Lovey, I say. What about you? What is your name?
My name,
she whispers.
My name? She called me Ama, but I had another name.
I sense her agitation and try to soothe her. I seek a way into her memories, but I cannot find one. She has built a wall around herself. When she tilts her head, her profile manifests briefly. The curves of her face strike a deep and visceral chord. I feel like I'm catching a glimpse of someone I've always known.
Corinna.
She sits down next to me.
That was my name. Before I was Alma, I was Corinna.
Corinna. I recognize the name, though it takes me a moment to realize why. Corinna was my grandmother's name, Quinn's wife. But it couldn't be. I open my mouth to ask her more, but her head whips around, as if she's heard something. Immediately, she is back in the air, vanishing into the trees. Something has spooked her. I run my mind along the borders of the forest. The wall is strong. No ghosts lurk near it. Then I feel it. For the second time this day, someone from the outside world enters the waiting place. But this time, it is not a trespasser. This time, it is someone returning home.
Chapter 59, The Nightbringer. In the deep shade of the waiting place, the ghosts sigh their song of regret instead of screaming it. The spirits are quelled. The Banu al-Martha has finally learned what it means to be the chosen of death. Shadows emerge from behind me, 14 in number. I know them, and I hate them, for they are the wellsprings of all my sorrows. The augurs. Do they still hear the screams of the jinn children who were slaughtered with cold steel and summer rain? Do they recall how my people begged for mercy even as they were sealed into the jinn grove? You cannot stop me, I say to the augurs. My vengeance is written. We are here to witness, Cain speaks. He is a far cry from the power-obsessed scholar king of a millennium ago. Strange to think that this withered creature is the same man who betrayed the jinn, promising peace while plotting destruction. Those who ignited the blaze must suffer its wrath, he says. What do you think will happen to you when all the magic you stole from my people is restored to them, I ask? The magic that has sustained you in your pitiful forms for all these years. We will die. You wish to die. Immortality was a more painful burden than you anticipated, was it not, Snake? I fashion my magic into a thick iridescent chain and lash the augurs to me. They do not fight it. They cannot. For I am home, and here amid the trees of my birth, my magic is at its most powerful. Fear no more, your majesty. You will die. Your pain will end, but first you will watch as I destroy everything you hope to save, so that you may know what your greed and violence have wrought. Cain only smiles, a vestige of his old conceit. The jinn will be freed, he says. The balance between worlds restored. But the humans are ready for you, Nightbringer. They will prevail. You poor fool, I seize him. And when he unleashes his power to throw me off, the air shimmers briefly, before I shake the attack away like a human would a mosquito. Look into my eyes, you wretch of a man, I whisper. See the darkest moments of your future. Witness the devastation I will unleash. Cain stiffens as he looks, as he sees in my gaze field upon field of the dead. Villages, towns, cities aflame. His people, his precious scholars, obliterated at the hands of my brethren, ground down until even their name is no longer remembered. The mariners, the tribes, the marshals, all under the bloody, iron-fisted rule of Keres Veturia. And his champions, those three flames in which he placed all his hopes, Lyra of Serra, Helene, Aquila, and Elias Veturius? I smother those flames, for I have taken the blood shrike's soul. The waiting place has taken the soul catcher's humanity, and I will crush Lyra of Serra's heart. The augur tries to turn away from the nightmare images. I do not let him. Still so arrogant, I say. So assured that you knew what was best. Your foretellings showed you a way to free yourselves and release the djinn while protecting humanity. But you never understood the magic. Above all else, it is changeable. Your dreams of the future only bloom if they have a firm hand to nurture them to life. Otherwise, they wither before they ever take root. I turn to the gin grove, dragging the struggling augurs with me. They push at me with their stolen magic, desperate to escape now that they know what is to come. I wrap them tighter. They will be free soon enough. When I arrive among the haunted trees, the suffering of my brethren washes over me. I want to scream. I drive the star into the ground. Now complete, it bears no sign of its splintering and stands as tall as I do, the four-pointed diamond hearkening to the symbol of Blackcliff. The augurs adopted the shape to remind themselves of their sins, a pathetic human notion that by drowning in guilt and regret, one can atone for any crime, no matter how despicable. When I place my hands on the star, the earth stills. I close my eyes. 1,000 years of loneliness. 1,000 years of deceit. 1,000 years of plotting and planning and atonement. All for this moment. Dozens of faces flood my mind, all those who possessed the star, all those I loved. Father, mother, brother, daughter, friend, lover. Release the djinn. The star groans in response to my command, the magic within its metal twisting, warping, pouring into me and drawing from me, both at once. It is alive. Its consciousness simple but thrumming with power. I seize that power and make it mine. The augurs shudder, and I bind them tighter, all but Cain. I weave a shield from my magic, protecting him from what is to come, though he will not thank me for it. Release the djinn! The trees moan awake, and the star fights me. Its ancient sorcery sluggish and unwilling to bend. You have held them long enough. Release them! A crack echoes through the grove, loud as summer thunder. Deep in the waiting place, the sows of the spirits transform into screams as one of the trees splits, then another. Flames pour from those great gouges, bursting forth as if the gates to all of the hells have been breached. My flames, my family, my djinn. The trees explode into cinders, their glow painting the firmament an infernal red. Moss and shrubs curdle to soot, leaving an acres-wide black ring. The earth shudders. a tremor that will shatter glass from Marin to Navium. I taste fear on the air, from the augurs and the ghosts, from the humans that infest this world. Visions flash across my mind. A scarred soldier cries out, reaching for daggers that will not help her. A newborn babe awakes, howling. A girl I once loved gasps, wheeling her horse about to gaze with gold eyes at the crimson sky over the forest of dusk. For an instant, every human within a thousand leagues is united in a moment of ineffable dread. They know. Their hopes, their loves, their joy. All will soon be naught but ash. My people stagger toward me, their flames coalescing into arms, legs, faces. First a dozen, then 20, then hundreds. One by one, they tumble from their prisons and gather near me. At the edge of the clearing, 13 of the 14 augurs silently collapse into heaps of ash. The power that they siphoned from the djinn flows back to its rightful owners. The star crumbles. Dusty remnants swirling restlessly before disappearing on a swift wind. I turn to my family. Beshem, I say. My children. I gather the flames close, hundreds and hundreds of them. Their heat is a balm on the soul I thought I had long since lost. Forgive me, I beg them. Forgive me for failing you. They surround me, touch my face, pull away my cloak, and release me into my true form, the form of flame, which I have repressed for 10 centuries. You freed us, they murmur, our king, our father, our Meheria. You did not forget us. The humans were wrong. I had a name once, a beautiful name, a name spoken by the great dark that came before all else, a name whose meaning brought me into existence and defined all I would ever be. My queen spoke my name long ago. Now my people whisper it. Meheria. Their long-banked flames blaze brighter, from red to incandescent white, too bright for human eyes, but glorious to mine. I see their power and magic, their pain and rage. I see their soul-deep need for vengeance. I see the bloody reaping to come. Meheria! My children say my name again, and the sound of it drops me to my knees. Meheria! Beloved.
This is Fiona Hardingham. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Reaper at the Gates by Saba Tahir. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Saba Tahir. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.